sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Bitcoin crashes. China exports rise, beating estimates. Stocks surge on unemployment data. And our guest, Larry McMillan from the OptionStrategist.com, will be talking about option strategies and more. All this and lots more to come on episode number 342 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, how are you? Andrew Horowitz here for another episode of All Things Related to Your Investing and Money. And today we're going to have a great guest on because I've been asked by a lot of people, a lot of you have written into me and asked about, hey, can we talk about options a little bit here? We really haven't had anybody on talking about that. And I thought that it was about time to do so. So we went right to the top of the chain of people who know all about this important area of investing. It's a little bit different than your traditional investing because it has much more risk and much more volatility, but it can be a great tool for you to use when it comes to either hedging or looking for some substantial profit opportunity because it is so highly leveraged. Got a few things to talk about today before we get with our guest, and I thought we would start off with some of the things that have happened over the last week and then looking into what we should expect moving forward. The last week we had talked about that we're going to put up a stock per day of turkey stocks, those stocks that looked like they were really having some difficulty. And I got to tell you something, I tried. We tried, but too many things came into the way last week and we got two or three of the stocks up. And actually those turned out to be pretty good short opportunities. We had D.R. Horton up there and it rose a bit, but then came back down. And we also had WT offshore, which did come down about 5 or 6% on Friday and had some pretty weak days in between. One nice day, but other than that, it was pretty weak. Oil did, in fact, come up from a pretty low level compared to where it's been lately, and a lot of that has been blamed on two things in particular. One of them is the opening of the sudden leg of the Keystone Pipeline. And what that really is all about, and I thank many of my guests for sending in some comments on this, because at first, you look at the reason why oil prices went up, and you say, wait a minute, that doesn't make a lot of sense. Because what happened was that now you're opening up the pipeline, and you have a lot more potential for overall supply. Now, just thinking of that on its own, you say, well, if you have more supply of oil, why would you have a price increase? That doesn't make any sense at all. Okay, fine. But you know, at the same time, it seemed what happened was that the mix of the difference between WTI crude and Brent now is going to possibly change, and the more expensive crude will be coming down, and there'll be a lot more of that, and it would shut down some of the lower cost crude, and therefore pricing would start to go higher. The second thing was, it's a little more complex than that, but that's essentially the reasoning. The second part was that inventories saw a tremendous drawdown. The API inventories that came out after the close on Tuesday when oil was up about 3.5% after this news that started to move this, down like 15 million barrels compared to an estimate of about, I don't know, 1 million or so. And then the next day that followed on with the DOE, the official 1030 report on Wednesday, that came out and showed that there was also a substantial drawdown in oil. Now, why? Well, there's a lot of reasons. Refining capacity moved up and was doing a little bit better. But at the same time, you know, they can move that anywhere they want because they could slow down production or increase production. At the same time, you're looking at OPEC, who did not increase their production. So right there, there's kind of three things that may have been at play going into the reason why oil went from about 92 and changed to about 97 and a half for the week, one of the biggest rises that we saw in months. And at the same time, the dollar moved a lot higher. Now, one of the things that has been a constant conversation that we've been having is the breakdown of correlations. Traditionally, when you have the dollar moving higher, what you usually see is that commodities and gold, oil will move in the opposite direction because they're priced in those currencies. That didn't happen. With some of the news that we saw last week, the idea that the tapering, the slowing, I guess it would be best to describe, as the slowing of bond purchases by the Fed from the $85 billion per month may start to show through a little bit here because we did see better than expected numbers on a couple of areas. Now, at the same time, we did see some economic numbers that were a little soft. So you have to balance that. But remember something, we're in a glass is half full versus half empty environment where we're seeing a lot of the positive data very well accepted and the negative data just totally just put aside and said, well, it's an aberration or it's a one time or things are really getting better. That may be the case. Okay. So it's a change in the sentiment of the investor, the economist, the analyst who is looking at all this and putting it all together and therefore saying that stocks will deserve a higher price and at the same time saying that maybe there's going to be a taper sooner than later. As a matter of fact, we saw that there's a new survey out that said that the potential for a taper, maybe from $85 billion to $75 billion, let's say, is up. It's now 50-50 for the December meeting. Now, how much will happen or not? At this point, when you look at the numbers that came out last week, a 7% unemployment rate with an increase of the labor participation rate, which is opposite of what's been happening. Usually you'd see that the decrease in the unemployment rate is due to the fact that you have a lower population overall of people working. That was not the case last month. Now, that may be a statistical anomaly in itself because we did say last week that we thought that over the next couple of months, you will see a natural progression towards a lower labor participation rate due to the fact that you're going to see the many of the extended unemployment benefits run out, and those people that will be now off all the potential emergency benefits that were afforded to them starting in about December, January, are going to be out of work and potentially out of the labor force. Now, with the budget talks moving forward, and each day we're finding there's potential for a agreement by the due date, and then we're seeing it there's not, there is the potential for another extension of unemployment benefits. Now, for all of you out there that are unemployed, hey, I think it is important that there is the ability for you to actually have money and to, you know, meet your needs. And if the government is going to provide that, great. But there is some negative effects from this. Let's be honest. The fact that we have so many people on the unemployment and the disability rolls right now is a real negative towards long-term economic expansion. I don't think there's any argument to that. And the question also remains, if you keep the unemployment benefits going, does that somehow have a negative influence on people looking to actually find work? I don't think there's an easy answer to this, and I don't think any of us really have the ability to really forecast this because a lot of the things that are going on right now in terms of government intervention and stimulus are all experimental. They've never been done before at these levels. And therefore, we're seeing some very strange movement in things. As an example, well, we saw oil go up last week. Gold fell off pretty well when the unemployment number came out on Friday, adding about 200,000 or so to the unemployment, to the employment rolls, and a 7% unemployment rate. And gold really came in on that, but then it kind of started moving back higher. We saw that bonds were being bought on Friday. Now, if there is going to be a taper and there is the belief that this was a good unemployment rate, you would have naturally, in theory, seen that bonds would have been sold off more because the idea that you see that the Fed is going to slow down on their purchases is going to affect the potential amount of buyers, because they are the majority of treasuries, that is. They're the majority buyer right now of all treasuries that are being issued or that are being held. I mean, they have just the balance sheet has been expanded in trillions of dollars. It's $85 billion per month is almost $1 trillion per year. That's a lot of money that's being bought in, whether it's MBS, municipal-backed securities, or it is a mortgage-backed security, or whether it's going to be treasuries. So this is an interesting time because there is going to be a time in the future that the Fed is going to have to step out of this. Now, does that mean they're going to reduce their stimulus? Well, yeah, it does. Does it mean that it's going to do a lot of damage to the markets? Well, liquidity will dry up. No question about that. Is it going to be very negative to the economy? My answer is that one day, the economy is going to have to be out of the very high level of intensive care. Feeding tubes will have to be removed and the IVs taken out. And those are the equivalent of stimulus in order to see if the economy, if we're going to use the metaphor here as the patient, to recover on their own. That's going to be an important part of this whole process. And we're not just talking here in the U.S. We're talking about around the world, the same thing going on. Now, we talked about how China, who had been a major driver of global expansion in, we'll say, 2009, 2010, a big part of the ability for the contraction that went on around the world was helped by the fact that China had issued a stimulus well before, about 6 months before the U.S., and it was in its size much greater than what was issued by the U.S. And I think at the time it was $700 billion or so, and that in terms of their economy and, more importantly, the amount of money equivalent to the income per capita was much greater by a multiple than the U.S. and the stimulus that was provided then. And therefore, that really supercharged their infrastructure development and their economy, and you saw the recovery there much sooner than the U.S. Well, then they started to pull back on that because they saw inflation, and they started to say, hey, you know what? We've issued a lot of various stimulus in the beginning and interimly, and you know, the inflation rate is really picking up. We're going to increase the value of our currency, as has been requested by the U.S. and the world, to keep pace with what the realistic value is from our economy, and so on. And then what happened is that their economy really slowed, the markets really contracted, and they started to really see some problems. Well, they lightened up on some of that, and then we saw the expansion start again. Now, the exports that came out over the weekend saw that there was a big rise in the exports, and there was a rise in imports, but much less than expected. Exports did expand much greater. Here's what I have to say about that. Who cares? The fact is that we really can't judge at this point, even though markets will probably cheer this, you really can't judge how well this is compared to what it should have been because of the change in the structure of the import-export numbers not too long ago. We know that there was some fraudulent practices that were in place by many of the people who were doing the import-export, and they were doing things like importing goods that were not supposed to be, like currencies, gold, etc., and putting them on maybe once or twice at the level that they were supposed to be, and some of that wasn't even supposed to be included in the import and export statistics. China agreed that, hey, there's something wrong here, and we're going to put a clamp on this, but who knows what the comparison really should have been. So we're not even going to bring that up into this discussion because we're going to try to, you know, keep it real, as they say. Let's keep it real. Let's not bring up these kind of numbers that we really have no ability to do anything about in terms of understanding what the metric really should be. But clearly the unemployment data in the U.S. was something that was very good because we did not see the labor participation rate really have as much of an impact on this. And there is a clear movement from initial claims lower, which we did see also. And we did see that there is spending that's going on in the U.S., but still not at the level that should be on a retail sales front. As a matter of fact, many of the same store sales that came out over this week were kind of weak. You can see that they're starting to trickle in, and we're seeing that the same store sales and the outlooks are much lower than were anticipated. Now, I would keep an eye on these retail stocks, the whole entire lot of them, and particularly watch for some of the ones that have a greater amount of volatility and a greater amount of exposure to some of the younger people. You know, you're talking about things like Aeropostale and American Eagle and Zumiez. These are stocks that have had a lot of volatility and really show in advance what's happening with the economy. And clearly, one of the things that we are seeing is, for whatever reason, while there is spending going on, there's a bit of a slower spending that's happening. But let's get to our guest, talk about options, because there's a few things that I want to talk. I want to ask about the VIX. There's something about the VIX I have a few questions on. And then I'll get back to talking about some things like, for example, what's going on with Bitcoin. You saw that plunge. We'll talk about that in a bit. We'll talk also about some of the hedge funds, what's going on in that world, and a few other topics that I think we have to be prepared for moving on into next week, inclusive of where commodities are and what the projections may be into the end of the year as well as next year. So let's get right to our guest. I mentioned that we're going to have a specialist on regarding options for some time, and this is the guy that I was pointed to. We've just met recently, and I know that he has a wealth of knowledge to talk about. He writes a newsletter. He has a great website, theoptionstrategist.com. He has a lot of tools that are built for option strategies. So, Larry, you're going to help to inform us and enlighten us about the world of options. How's that sound?
All right. That's
so, real. So there's a lot of different things. You know, options have these really kind of interesting names. You know, you just buy and sell a stock, but options, you can have these condors and butterflies and various spreads and all this. Tell us about, like, what you like to look at, and in plain English, you know, inform the listeners about, you know, what's the point about options? Why should somebody trade it? Why shouldn't they, et cetera?
Right. Well, first of all, most of the option trading we do is I try to keep it simple. I mean, all the complicated spreading strategies and all that stuff, you know, they're good on paper, but in reality, you know, they're more of a professional sort of thing, and I don't think the average, the average person really gets the benefit of those, either because of high commission expenses or just general friction of buying on the bid and selling on the offer, that sort of thing, which market makers don't have to do. So we try to keep it pretty simple. But the number one thing that options allow you to do is define your risk. So you go in and you have X amount of dollars. Let's say you have a risk trading account. We recommend that people don't put more than 3 to 5% of their trading account in any one option position. And then, since an option has a fixed cost, that's it. You put that money in. That's the most you could possibly lose in that one situation. And with that, you know, people feel, generally anyways, people feel that, you know, that they've got a better handle on risk and risk controls. Obviously, you can get a lot more sophisticated than just doing it that way, but at least that's a start, and you have you know exactly where you stand with respect to your P&L, and you don't have to necessarily worry about a stock gapping down on you. If you're in a stock and you're using stop orders, you know, they're okay, except sometimes a stock can go right through your stop order and, you know, just kind of leave you hanging out there high and dry. With an option, you can't lose more than you paid for it.
Right, exactly. So, now, and options are levered. And one of the things I always say about options is that you have to be right twice. So you have to be right in direction and time.
Right. Well, again, there are ways to compensate for that. But, you know, in general, I understand what you're saying, that, you know, the option has a time value in it. And if you're buying out of the money option, for example, then you better have the stock make a pretty quick move, or you're going to run out of time. But we generally recommend in the money options that actually have some intrinsic value, so that if the stock, moves up, they'll move up pretty quickly with it. And there's a measure on the options called the delta of an option that tells you how well it's going to respond to stock price movements. This you can usually get the delta from your broker's option trading platform, or if not, you can go. There's a free website at the CBOE where you could get it as well. But a delta runs between 0 and 1. So if an option has a delta of 0, that means it's not responsive to the stock price movement at all. It's so far out of the money and so little time remaining that you're basically just taking a real, you know, crapshoot or something like that. On the other hand, a delta can be as high as 1, then it behaves exactly like stock, which maybe isn't what you want either. But an at-the-money option, let's say, you know, if you're just going to go in today and say, oh, I don't buy calls on Walgreens trading around 56 and change, you might buy the 55 call, it would have a delta of like 0.6. So it moves at 60% of the rate of the stock price. So if the stock goes up $1, the option will go up 60 cents. And therefore, really, if you're right on the stock in that kind of an option, then you're going to make money. But if you're right on the stock and it's moving up, you're getting 60% of that movement at least, and that's going to overcome any time decay worries that you might have. So the thing where you have to be right twice really only applies if you're talking about out-of-the-money options, which we tend to discourage people from buying.
Right. Now, in terms of the idea of, you said intrinsic value. I just want to kind of make sure everybody understands that. So intrinsic value is the value of the option that it has according to the value, let's say, of a stock. So if the stock is trading at 50 and you have a call, which you would want, you buy a call, you'd want the stock to move up, and your call strike, let's say, is 49, well, you have a $1 of intrinsic value. In other words, you're in the money.
Right.
The call is profitable at this point. And the rest of that, whatever it's worth, is time value, which erodes over time the closer and closer you get towards expiration, whatever that expiration date is.
Right, exactly. And also, okay, that, you know, it's always funny when I'm giving my lectures, I usually say that's a misnomer. Yes, you're right, over time it does disappear, but, you know, if we're talking about an option, say, with even as little as a couple of weeks remaining, but say a month or 2 months, that part that's not the intrinsic value is much more responsive to changes in volatility, implied volatility, than the actual time. Yes, it will disappear with time, but if traders perceive that the stock is going to become more volatile, that part will beef up. And if traders perceive that the stock is not going to be volatile, that part can dull down. And so you really need to kind of be mindful of how volatility is behaving as well, because it's a big factor in how options are priced and how they behave.
Now I know there's a lot of Greek symbolism, mm-hmm, and math words. You get delta. There's also the theta, right?
Right, theta is time decay, the rate of time decay.
So that also gives you, now what do you look for there?
Well, you know, typically I'm not really looking for a specific number there. I'm just, as I said before, I'm trying to control my time decay variable, if you will, by buying a slightly in the money option, or even a more deeply in the money option. It just doesn't really have that much time value remaining in it. You know, that most of the stuff is intrinsic value. If you end up trying to worry too much about the theta, I think you're going to end up missing on some. You know, that's where sort of the math becomes a bit of a trick. You end up getting in a situation where you end up in the wrong option and you didn't even realize you were in the wrong option. It just sort of worked out that way. But typically, theta is not something I don't think you should really be basing your option purchase on, as long as you understand it.
Mm-hmm.
In general, so we're not buying these deep out-of-the-money options.
Right. So we're talking about delta, which is important for the responsiveness of the option. We're talking about the amount that it has of intrinsic value, or what the value in the money or out, and you know, how much time is left to give us some kind of a way to sort and figure out what we want to go for. What is the first step to say, okay, you know, there's all these stocks and there's all these indices and ETF. I mean, I could buy options on all sorts of things. What's the first step? What should I be looking for in order to get a bit of a filtering in so I can start looking at a few of the potential options that I would like to maybe enter.
Right. Well, the number one thing that I always say is, you know, it's not even an option thing. It's just have a good system for picking stocks, whether, you know, it's a technical or fundamental approach that you have. If you because if you can't make a profit, if you buy a call option, it's going to be very, very difficult to make a profit on it if the stock doesn't go up. So you really need to concentrate on your stock picking. And in order to do that, of course, you've got to have a good system. I mean, we're technical analysts, so we look at things like put call ratios or, you know, even just plain charts that we look at. Volume in the stock, volume in the options, those sorts of things. I think those are all important. Other people might disagree to a certain extent. But, you know, once you've selected the stock by whatever system you have, even if it's some of William O'Neill's kind of, you know, earnings-driven things or, you know, the seven steps or Can Slim or, you know, any of those things, then you can pick an option. And then then we get back into, you know, which option would it be? If you're looking for a short-term trade, I would say you would want to go with a fairly deeply in-the-money short-term option so it really behaves like the stock does. If you're looking a little bit longer term, then, you know, maybe an out-the-money option.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now one of the things we talk about is volatility. And we know that when you have, you could have, theoretically, a price of a stock maintained constant, and you could have an option, let's say you bought an in-the-money option, and let's say you have 2 months that are moving out. So the stock doesn't go anywhere, but volatility picks up all around it. In other words, the markets become much more volatile, and then you could possibly get just a natural lift to that particular option value, right?
Right. That can happen, yeah. I mean, I would say that's unusual, but certainly can happen.
So when we look at more recent levels of like the VIX, which is, you know, it used to be called the fear indicator. It used to be a pretty good level of understanding about volatility. And, you know, it dropped down to the 12s and 13s, which, you know, you're a little bit older than I am, but, you know, you don't see that often, right?
True. Yeah,
so, you know, 15 has always been that demarcation point that I look at.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just kind of just as a general number. And, you know, you see it less than that, and you start wondering, because a lot of times in the quote-unquote old days, when you saw a VIX that really got down to that level, there was a lot of complacency in the markets, and there was this whole idea that, wait, there could be a reversal. Now, do you trade the VIX at all?
We're very heavily involved with VIX, yeah.
Okay. Can you talk to us a little bit about the VIX and any changes that you've seen and what the strategy would be? And by the way, I think you have some things on TradeStation that are available, right?
Yeah, we've done some lecturing there about volatility and trading VIX and using it as an indicator and things, but it's sort of a deep subject, but let me just come in on it. And, you know, what it basically is, VIX itself is an invention of the CBOE, and they use their own SPX options, the S&P 500 options. The implied volatility of those makes up the index. So you're right, it is a fear indicator. Supposedly, when the market crashes, VIX goes spiking higher, and when the market gets complacent, it goes very low. What happens let me add one other thing. They, a few years ago, introduced futures and options on VIX, which allowed traders to supposedly trade volatility directly, although I think there's been some misconceptions about how that actually works as well. But it's certainly, I think, a very useful thing for a number of people, especially in terms of hedging their portfolios and things. But anyways, that's for deviates. I wanted to give you just one simple way to use VIX. So this is the simplest and I think probably the best way is to watch for it to make a spike peak during a bearish move in the market. So right now, market started to top out here a little bit, and VIX popped up above. VIX has been trading between 12 and 14 for about 2 months, a month and a half anyways, and that's a pretty low level, as you just mentioned. So that's danger territory, and still is danger territory even these days, although it can stay down there for a long time, just like markets can remain overbought for a long time. Anyways, now VIX has popped up a little bit. And if you start to see VIX increase at the rate where it's increased at least 3 points, let's say within three trading days, then to me it's really flying at that point. And now you watch for it to form a peak. When it forms a peak, that's a buy signal for the market. So if you have the availability of looking at a chart of VIX, go back and look this year, you'll see there's about six distinct peaks on that chart, and every single one of those is a good buy point for the broad stock market. So that's the simplest way that we use VIX, and it's a very effective way of using it.
Now, I mean, if you go from 12 to 15, that's a pretty significant in a short period of time.
Right.
That's a pretty significant move up. Now, again, we're starting to talk about how, well, it's starting from a very low position. I mean, if it was 20 and it went up three, that's not as much of a percentage move. But I do agree with you. If you look at the times that the VIX has actually moved up, the next move has been significantly lower. I mean, it crashes down.
Right.
You know, it's almost, you know, straight up then straight down.
Yeah.
The thing is that, you know, we still don't know the level of quote unquote normal VIX levels back to when it was historically, you know, if we go back over time. But, you know, the thing is that the VIX on an intraday basis is also very interesting because it does move on an intraday basis. And you can almost see the amount of buying or selling that goes on with the movement of the VIX, you know, kind of hedging, I guess, one way or the other. The problem that we've come into is that the VIX has become available in all these ETFs, and many of them don't actually trade directly with the VIX, and what they're doing is with synthetics or rolling, and it's just a disaster because of contango.
Right. So, yeah, that's what I was saying. The futures have ostensibly allowed people to trade VIX, but there are some problems, and those are what you're talking about there, right? The futures are the basis for all of these ETFs, like VXX, VIX, etc., TVIX, all of them. And so whatever's happening in the futures premium is affecting those products as well. And, of course, as you referred to, they've been kind of miserable in terms of protection. But and I don't know how technical you want to get here, but there's a thing called the term structure, which is basically if you just look at the prices of the various futures, you can see right now they all go up. The cheapest is December, then January is more expensive, then February is more expensive. So they're going up in a row like that, a positive slope, if you want to look at it that way, from a just math term or what have you. When that's the case, then VIX, then VXX. Gets hurt. It's the rolling, the daily rolling activity that's required to maintain that that ETN, that's actually an ETN, is you're paying the toll every day, paying a little price every day. It makes it underperform VIX itself. So, but in a bearish market, that turns around, goes the other way, then VXX does actually outperform. We just haven't had one for so long, and everybody's forgotten about that part of it, I think.
Yeah, because we had the backwardation of the futures. But, you know, it was interesting that last month, I believe it was, there was such a differential between the 2 months. But it was almost, you know, you'd only hold it for a few days.
But now, you can trade that sort of thing as a spread, but and which we do in one of our newsletters, but that's a little bit more sophisticated strategy.
Exactly. Okay. The other thing is that options are essentially leveraged in terms of the way they react. I mean, we talk about how if the stock moves up a dollar, which is maybe a $35 stock, and a $2 option moves up 60 cents on that, let's say, for example, or 40 cents. I mean, that's a big leveraged move comparatively.
Right.
So, you know, options are very leveraged. And there's a lot of ways to do it. Like you said, you can do all sorts of spreads, you know, where you can kind of buy. You don't only buy, you can sell. The same option at a different date, and you have things like calendar spreads where you take that, or you take a price spreads where you may take something at a 35 and then sell the 32. You could sell and just try to make income off of calls, right? You could or puts for that matter.
Right.
And you know, there's a lot of different things. Like we talked about the condors and the butterflies and the just keep going on iron condors, right? All these different crazy names for things. And there are ways in many of the software programs to structure these. They're all risk-related to try to minimize risk and grab a kind of piece off of if there is, and I guess we you would agree with it, if there's a inequity or a pricing a fallacy in one of the two, which doesn't usually happen.
Right, but there aren't too many pricing fallacies anymore, you know, because of the way that computers are watching things, you know, so if you think you've found a real pricing anomaly, you might want to take a second look.
Exactly. Exactly. I got this. Oh, my God, look, it's a $10 no-brainer, no guarantee. And at the end, you're like, how did I lose $5 on this deal?
Right.
You know, how did that happen?
Exactly.
So that's great. So there's a lot of tools that you offer, and of course, you do speak quite often. You have this great book out, and also on the site, give us the exact site name.
It's www.optionstrategist.com.
Okay, and we'll have that link on the website. A lot of listeners have asked about this and asked about, you know, how do we get into options? Should we get into options? So this is the place that you can get a nice in-depth discussion of this and some ongoing quote-unquote advice through his, you know, through his newsletter and all that. So, hey, Larry, I appreciate you coming aboard.
Okay. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll talk soon. Profitabilities to you.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye-bye. So if you're looking for a book, an understanding of how to get involved in some of the strategies about options, he has a new book out, and we put the link on the show notes for this episode. So just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can click on the link that will give you the access to his book. And if you want to buy it, you want to see what's going on there. And he has several other books and editions out about the strategies behind options and gives you all the things you need to do. You need to have a good platform to make sure that you have the options pricing and understanding of the different strikes and the values that we talked about, like the delta, etc. And you could do that with most platforms out there. Some of the online trading brokers that have just simple web applications or web interfaces that just give you the pricing may not give you all the things that you need, but there's some very good ones out there, whether it's thinkorswim. I believe that there's Option Monster. Our friend over John Najarian has some good things over there. You can look at TradeStation, and there's a couple of other ones out there that have some very good charting because you want to see what the decay looks like on the stock over on the option over time. And it's important to have some kind of visuals. I always think it's important to have some kind of visuals about how it will perform under different circumstances and where the break evens are and where the profit margins are and the levels are. And often you can see that in a chart, and there's some good ones that you can see. And if you get into some of the more sophisticated option strategies, whether you're doing some spreads or strangles or any of the other ones that we talked about, that is really important to also visualize to see where the break-evens are and where the potential levels of losses are. You know, when you're doing covered calls or you're selling a put or buying a put against a long position, you want to see kind of where the ranges are in all of that. So that's important to have that, and the different ones that I just mentioned have a good amount of that. There's other ones too. Options Express, there's a few others. So let's get back to some of the things we were talking about. I mentioned about Bitcoin earlier, and I've been talking about this because I think it's fascinating, and it really represents not just about Bitcoin. Let's get this straight. I'm not really talking only about Bitcoin when I bring this topic up. I'm talking about the concept of the excess amount of speculation right now that's in the market and the potential for volatility. Now, we haven't seen that, although we did see 5 days down for the Dow, for example. I think we haven't seen that in decades. A string of 5 days down. Now, was it really bad? It was bad. It wasn't awful. Maybe 2%. But then again, you saw that move straight up on Friday with the jobs number. One of the things that was interesting about the jobs number when it first came out, futures, because it comes out before the market opens on the first Friday of the month, futures sold off dramatically. You saw that there was a big move lower in futures because the idea that we had such a quote-unquote strong number was going to be very negative to the markets due to the fact that there will be tapering or be a withdrawal of some of the stimulus really spooked investors. And then it turned around and started moving much higher, and we had just a blowout day on very tepid volume, by the way. That was the one surprising factor that I saw on Friday. I was really interested in how there was really not much volume. It was maybe a 1% better than a 10-day average that we've recently seen. And that was concerning. That was surprising. You would have expected to see, after 5 days of down, a little bit of more participation that was involved. I still believe that we are seeing a lot of short covering on these kind of situations. Shorts are very spooked because they have not had a good time with markets or stocks recently. When you see that there is a move down, it breaks down, and then just turns around and recaptures most of that in a day or so. Shorts have really been, it's been very difficult. Any the shorts that we've been on, there's been a lot of difficulty there as well. You know, you hit a few, and then you maybe trim the position, take some profits, and then it turns around on you pretty violently. Or, you know, you every once in a while there are those really good ones that hold and stay down there and hit your targets. But it's been a very difficult ride for anybody that's playing the short side of this market, as you know. That doesn't mean that it should be thrown away and not a strategy that's used. It will turn. Now, it may not turn today and it may not turn tomorrow, but listen, let's not get into the frame of mind that the markets are going up forever. It may go for a year, 2 years. It may be that you see some, you know, lack of volatility, but then again, everything cycles. Right now, as I mentioned, the retail is really in focus because the retail often is a way to foretell and foresee what's happening in an economy. It's all based on spending in the U.S. We know about 70% of it. So, but Bitcoin, to get back to the Bitcoin, there was some interesting news over the weekend. Two things. First, Tesla accepted its first Bitcoin transaction to buy a car. It was out in California. They wouldn't give the name of the actual purchaser of that, but they did so say that they took Bitcoin in to purchase a car, and they said something to the effect of, hey, it's okay, as long as we can convert it to dollars, we're good. So maybe they did, in fact, take the money from the Bitcoin and convert it. But the other news, which was much more powerful and did, in fact, affect the price of Bitcoins, happened late in the week when China said, you know what? Bitcoin is not going to be able to be accepted anymore in China. And Baidu, the search engine, the equivalent of, let's say, a Google in China, who did accept Bitcoin for certain transactions, stopped it dead on its tracks. And what happened was that Bitcoin, which was trading at about $1,250 at the high earlier in the week, went down as low as about $560 over the weekend. Trading right now on Sunday somewhere about, I would say, about $710. So it did come back a bit. But the concern that governments may get involved and disallow this to be used as a payment, currency for payments, is really weighing down the value. And you still look at that over the last 30 days, the value of Bitcoin is still up about 125%. So you're seeing that this move on a weekend of 40% on the downside is still in the context of a massive move that we saw this year. Now, whether or not this does play out like did last weekend, where there was a big drop over the weekend, about 25% or so, and then it just picked right back up, or whether this is going to be something greater because you are seeing that a government actually came in with a ruling, or at least an edict, that this is going to be a problem. You know, you wonder what's going to happen here. But I will share with you that the bigger picture here is that the amount of speculation that's going on, and when liquidity dries up, because this is really a look into what happens when liquidity dries up, because now all of a sudden you have one market that's not going to allow it. And if it doesn't allow it, then therefore you have a lack of liquidity. And you also saw that there was a couple of sites that were seized in China because it was a fraudulent site that was dealing with Bitcoin. They took in millions of dollars, and there was really nothing backing it. Now, obviously, stock markets, for the most part, are, for the majority, really, the 99.8% 8%, and not that kind of situation. We don't have a stock market that is fraudulent, that is, you know, any of the main stock markets. So you're not going to see that kind of situation. You won't see the government step in and say, hey, you can't buy stocks anymore. That's not going to happen either. But what you do have is the overall speculation levels, where you see margin levels at the highest they've been since 2007. You see that the amount of investors that are coming into the marketplace, extremely high. You see that short interest overall is very low. Some of the lowest you've seen recently, because a lot of shorts have just totally thrown in the towel and said, forget it, I'm not going to be shorting right now. And, you know, what you have is a culmination of many different features and factors, like the options interest and the put interest, et cetera, that is starting to signal a very much concerning level. Now, still, realize that there are some excellent stocks out there and excellent opportunities individually. But we're talking about a bigger discussion here of the overall level of speculation in the markets and the bullishness in markets. And when you see that these kind of moves where you have a downstroke for 5 or 6 days and then just a big upstroke, and you're seeing this kind of volatility start to kick in, you have to take a pause and wonder, hey, what is the next cycle going to be? We haven't seen a major sell-off in many, many months. 1-2% maybe. I think 2% is the max. That was this week. So you have to look at this in the context of what we're seeing, and that is a very high level of positive sentiment towards the markets, and also a very high level of speculation because of excess liquidity. One of the things you're not seeing is hedge funds yet to buy into this idea that markets are going to be straight up forever. In fact, many hedge funds are trailing the S&P by the most they have since 2005. Overall, if you look at the comparison of hedge funds, the universe of hedge funds, and the S&P 500, which a lot of them do use as a benchmark, hedge funds are about 22% on average lower than their benchmark this year. That is an extremely wide margin. So whether or not they use the end of the year as a catch-up or not, or they take the year and just toss it in the garbage and say, hey, you know what? There's no way we can catch up here, which they can't, unless there's something miraculous happens. You have to wonder what they're going to actually be doing to set up for next year. Will they be holding back and or maybe even adding to the markets with the idea that, hey, you know what? There's a lot of positive discussion going on about where the markets are going to be next year and earnings. Not as positive and not as surprising as we've seen this year from the aspect of the rate of growth on EPS, although not revenue, that came in better than analysts expected, although still lower overall growth than we've seen. Therefore, that's why we're seeing the PE ratio at about 17 or so, because of course the earnings haven't kept up with the growth ratio. Earnings haven't kept up with the price movement. So that's why you see the PE expansion right now. And next year is the expectation, I think, overall, that you're still not going to see as great of a move, or the growth that we saw this year is going to slow down even further, and sales are going to slow down even further. Now, we have the dollar that has really risen pretty dramatically over the last several weeks. And in fact, you also saw the euro itself, because the concept and the thought out there is that the euro is not going to see a lot of price depreciation or decline due to the fact that the ECB has not really put out a lot of stimulus notes and they're less dovish. Although, this is what you're seeing in the headlines. Behind the scenes, we saw a cut of interest rates recently. We saw talk of negative interest rates. And really, Draghi hasn't been very much bullish or hawkish, even though there is some concern that has been circling around about the inflation rate and what they're going to do there. They're still very cautious about that. Their austerity measures are still in place for the most part. Greece's budget was accepted, whatever that means in the big picture. Because we know that, you know, we saw a 3-week market hysteria over Cyprus, which essentially went bankrupt, and then all of a sudden miraculously came back. We saw there was a multi-month concern in the beginning of the year and last year with Greece. We saw that the ratings cut on several of the major countries in the sovereign debt ratings, and on the European bailout fund, if you will, was cut also. These are not good signs. You're seeing better growth in some of the countries, but it couldn't have gotten much worse if the world was kind of cruising along at just basic rates at 3% for the U.S. We saw that amazing GDP number come out last week where GDP moved up to 3.6%. We saw that it's interesting. We saw that the first level of consumer confidence was not so great, but yet the University of Michigan came out at 82 on Friday for the preliminary of December. That's a strong number. 82 is a very strong consumer confidence number from the University of Michigan. Expectations were like 70, you know, high 70s. So when you're talking about an 82, that's a blowout. But, you know, here's the problem with these consumer confidence numbers. The consumer confidence numbers and what the feeling is on the current and the future situation don't always translate into what consumers are going to spend. We saw a couple of companies just totally nosedive. Ulta Cosmetics came out with some numbers last week, and I think it was down 22% on Friday. Really ugly. This is a chain of cosmetic stores that has been doing very well. They had a couple of plunges, then they had some really nice moves up. And we also saw, I thought it was very interesting, on Friday with the good unemployment numbers and the better-than-expected consumer confidence numbers, retail stocks being faded pretty much across the board. Retail stocks did not do very well, especially the specialty retailers and the retailers that focus in on women's apparel. And of course, maybe some of that was due to Ulta. But now we have to contend with the whole budget issue that's going to be coming up. And I will tell you, there's going to be a lot of flapping lips that are going to be telling us one day that there's everything's under control, the budget's in great shape, and we don't have to worry about the debt ceiling again. And then the next day, you're going to hear the opposite story. So you're going to see some volatility pick up there. Usually at the end of the year, there is a seasonality that towards the end of the year, towards the end of the month of December, you have a couple things that happen. First of all, you have volumes in the markets that start declining because more people are in vacation mode. The second thing is that due to the fact that you have decreasing volume and less people taking positions towards the end of the year, you may see just a bias towards an upside towards the end of the month, potentially. At the same time, when you have years like we've had now, there is the potential also for a lot of people taking profits into this year and booking it against maybe some losses they had and rotating their portfolios. We saw a lot of weakness in the last week or so with the small caps. And that could be due to the fact that there is some profits being booked because there's been some great profits in small caps that hit highs well before most of the major indices. So small caps were in play and there may be some profit taking there. And I think that's really going to be an interesting thing to watch, the weakness and the comparative spread between the returns of the large and the small caps moving into the end of the year. Usually in the beginning of the year, there's something called the January effect, which says that small caps will outperform large caps. And that's due to some of the tax selling that takes place at the end of the year towards the beginning of mid to December. And then you have to wait your 30 days for the wash sale, then buying them back in the beginning of the year or towards the 30-day period after they sold out of them. So there's a lot right now at stake. One of the things that I mentioned was that, you know, the economies and what's happening with commodities is a very fascinating situation. Just to give you a quick update in terms of the year-to-date performance of commodities, which is the baseline for what the economic expansion is around the world, right? Even though we saw some great numbers on imports and exports in China recently, or actually the exports, again, with the commentary, who cares? You know, you see gold down 26% this year, silver down 35%, platinum down 11%, aluminum's down 14%, copper's down 10%, corn down 39%, wheat down 18%, sugar down 14%, coffee down 26%. Is that going to stay? Or is it going to be a rotation that we usually see when things are down like this, that opportunities the next year or so come in and people say, hey, you know what? This is down so much at this point. How much further is it going to go? Gold is about $1,229. Is it going to really fade that much more? And if, in fact, we don't see the major effect of the dollar playing out on the correlations as much anymore, are we going to see that there is a play towards some of these commodities because they've seen such a downdraft in their pricing? The only things that are really up this year is we have natural gas up 22%. You have crude is up 6%. Brent crude is about flat. Gasoline is down 3%. Heating oil up 0.37. Palladium is up, 4%. And cotton is up 7%. That's about it. The rest of the numbers are miserable. The one that I really think is the most interesting to look at is copper. Because copper does have a lot to do with the manufacturing process, growth, and GDP numbers. So copper has been ailing, and that's not a great sign for economies. And the big question is right now is, without the overall stimulus of the U.S., if they do start to pare back a little bit, what's going to happen to many of these other markets? And with the strength of the dollar that we've been seeing lately, how is, you know, that going to really play out when it comes to the imports of U.S. goods in other countries? So that Shinzo Abe's process and his three core tenets of his stimulus for Japan has been working, hit or miss, depending on what particular economic indicator you look at. And the big thing really is the yen, and the yen has come down very strong in the last, let's say, 4 weeks, about 6 or 7%. And that's very good for the Japanese markets. And you'll see that if the yen does, in fact, move up and get stronger, let's say by 1%, you're seeing like a 2, 2.5% drop in the Nikkei and vice versa. So keep your eyes on currencies because they're really the core to all this right now, and how the hedge funds and how the players are moving money around really depends on what's happening with currencies. So going to wrap it up there. We talked about a lot of things. We'll have a lot more to discuss and a lot more on the website throughout the week. Don't forget about Trigger Point Research, a 14-day free trial. We put out a lot of alerts over the last couple of weeks, and a couple of good ones that you need to take a look at. So if you haven't done so already, make sure to get your 14-day free trial. It's very easy. There's no strings attached. You don't have to put on up a credit card. Go over to triggerpointresearch.com/free trial and just sign up. And you'll start getting alerts right to your email box or your text messaging, whatever you choose. We'll give you all the lowdown of what the price is that we're getting in at, what the price is that the alert triggered at, and where the stops are and the profit targets. And then you get interim updates throughout the week on idea generation of what's happening as well. So there may not be an alert every day. Then again, you can get three in a day. It may not be, you know, a lot during 1 week, and then another week you're getting a lot, because what's happening is we're looking for breakout potential or breakdown potential that has a high probability of playing out. It doesn't always play out that way, but we're looking for specific factors in a on a technical basis with mixed in some fundamentals that our algorithms are generating, and then send it right out to you with the highest probability. Anyway, thanks for joining me. If you want to write me, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.